We are kicking off this week our summer series as we go through selected psalms. Many of you have expressed that you're glad we're getting back to this practice. I don't know why. I think you enjoyed slogging through visions of Gog and Magog last summer in Ezekiel. But I'm excited to go through these psalms as well. This week we begin with Psalm 39, and it is a psalm of David. It's a lament, as many of the psalms are, but it's not your typical lament. It usually starts off with crying out to Yahweh, listing his pains, and then asking for help. Instead, as you'll see, David launches right into examining the bad place he is in due to his discontent with God. So hear now the word of the Lord. Psalm 39. I said, I will guard my ways that I might not sin with my tongue. I will guard my mouth with a muzzle so long as the wicked are in my presence. I was mute and silent. I held my peace to no avail. My distress grew worse. My heart became hot within me as I mused. The fire burned. Then I spoke with my tongue. O Lord, make me know my end and what is the measure of my days. Let me know how fleeting I am. Behold, you have made my days a few handbreadths, and my lifetime is as nothing before you. Surely all mankind stands as a mere breath. Surely a man goes about as a shadow. Surely for nothing they are in turmoil. Man heaps up wealth and does not know who will gather. And now, O Lord, for what do I wait? My hope is in you. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Do not make me the scorn of the fool. I am mute. I do not open my mouth, for it is you who have done it. Remove your stroke from me. I am spent by the hostility of your hand. When you discipline a man with rebukes for sin, you consume like a moth what is dear to him. Surely all mankind is a mere breath. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Hold not your peace at my tears, for I am a sojourner with you, a guest like all my fathers. Look away from me that I may smile again before I depart and am no more. The word of the Lord. Okay, all kids in the room, eyes up here. This is time for all of us, right? And God really cares about every kid in this room too, and wants you all to know how much he loves you and how he wants you to live. So, do you guys like to build sandcastles when you go to the beach? My kids love to build sandcastles. And one of the things my kids always want to do, they want to make sure the sandcastle is close enough to the water because they want to see if it can outlast the waves. You guys ever do that? It's one of the most fun parts of building a sandcastle, right? You dig a deep moat so the water can spill in there and not get the castle. And you build a big wall in front of the moat so the waves hit the wall and don't ruin your beautiful castle, right? But what usually happens? Does the sandcastle last forever? As much work as you want, usually something's going to get it, right? I remember one year we built a nice one. The waves didn't get it, but people stomped on it and still ruined it. And you know why? That's kind of a picture of things in this life. They won't last, right? This year we thought for sure we had a sandcastle that would last. They built a moat that was so deep it was over my kid's head. And the wall was so big we thought nothing would take out this sandcastle. And before we were even done, the tide came in so far that the water was even behind us. And our castle was just a little island, and slowly but surely the waves made it disappear so that there was no trace of it left. You couldn't even tell we put all that work into it. And the Bible says we should not put all our hope in things that will pass away like that, right? You work and work and work, but do the things on this earth last forever? Nope. But will your life in heaven last forever? Yep, it will. And God says we put our hope in what he gives us through Jesus. Nobody can take it away, right? Even when you sin, God has promised Jesus paid for those sins, so he won't ever stop loving you, and he'll take you to heaven with him forever. So we shouldn't get all concerned about things in this world that will pass away, right? Things like rewards or money or being popular, that stuff won't last forever. So we should put our hope in things that will. We should be thinking, God, help me find my happiness in things you do for me, not in just things that I want when I'm being selfish. And when you doubt that, remember, the thing he gave you that's better than anything you can ever have in this world, he's going to love you forever and take you to heaven where nothing will ruin your happiness, right? All right, so ask God to help you not be so concerned with just things like toys and sports and good things, but they shouldn't be more important than God to us, right? Ask God to help you, help him make his promises the most important thing for you, okay? All right, thanks for listening, guys. As I said, this is a lament, but not your usual one. David's in a bad place, and he just launches the psalm right from the bad place where he is. Why? Because he is not content in the Lord, and he's allowed that discontent to burn within him. And so this psalm, I think, is a very important reminder of how God helps us be content in him. We're going to look at three things in this psalm that will help us do that. First, we're going to look at what are the causes of our discontent with God. And then we'll look at God's response to our discontent. His first is loving discipline to help us in the midst of that. But then a final reminder that we are sojourners with him, that this world is not our home. We are journeying through this world to our ultimate destination, which is heaven with him. So, beginning, what are the causes of our discontent with God? We see David here is raging with self-righteous indignation. And he says, I'm not speaking. I'm keeping my mouth shut because I am not going to sin by speaking ill when I'm around these wicked people. Okay, and who are these wicked people? We don't really know. But we see in verse 6 what they're doing. They're heaping up wealth, but to no avail. They're not even going to know who gets it, right? It doesn't last. But they're heaping up this wealth, and that seems to be driving David crazy. And so he says, I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to say anything. And we know usually what happens when you set off on that road. You end up saying something, don't you? And before David's even opened his mouth, his heart has already condemned him. But when he says his heart gets hot, this is an extremely strong word, often used for wild kind of pagan worship. It's kind of complete temper meltdown is what he's saying here. He's as angry as he can get. And why? Well, often the Psalms speak about the injustice of this world, how we watch the wicked prosper and those who follow the Lord be oppressed. That's a common theme in the Psalms. That's not quite what's driving him crazy here. Because he doesn't go to things like, ah, but Lord, you are just. You will punish the wicked. That's what the other Psalms do when he deals with that theme. Right here, David's just plain envious. He's looking at what these wicked people have, and they're heaping it up, and it's driving him crazy. And so he is not taking comfort from God ultimately punishing the wicked, that they won't get away with this forever. David is realizing he is the one who needs to be dealt with because he is so envious of these wicked that are heaping up wealth. So before we step any farther out into this psalm, I want us to make sure we are putting ourselves properly where we belong. Because we do the very thing David's doing here, and we can't afford to have this just be a biographical window into David's struggles, okay? David is going to mirror all of us here. Every one of us struggles to some degree with some form of discontent with God, often because we are envious of some other situation. And every one of us struggles with different aspects of this, okay? I'm not going to get overly specific in case your old self will say, oh, I never envied that, so I guess I don't have this problem, okay? I'm going to let it stay sufficiently broad enough so that you guys ask God, show me. Show me where I am not content with what you've given me. Show me where I am envying things. And I think there's some categories where we do what David does here. Often we are envying the wicked, right? We either look at the way they do get rich by just promoting themselves all the time. And yeah, that is a way to get rich and powerful, but it's wrong to be so self-centered. But we look at the success they achieve from and we think, oh, if I only sat down on that road, I could have that too. often in work situations. You see the people who do step over others, who steal credit for other people's things, who try to undermine good things that perhaps you've done, and it makes you very discontent. Understandably so. But we cannot then aim that at God and say, I have a right to hate you. Often we don't aim the words at him. But often our hatred of the situation is saying, I deserve better at your hand, God. But there's times, let's be honest, when some of our envy is not simply at the wicked out there. It is at some of those who the Lord has put in our life, those who are often closest to us. Whether it's within family, within tight circles of friends, often we can have those relationships ruined by envying whatever it is they may have that you don't have. And too often when we think of envy, we think of just things that we're envious of. They own something. They can afford certain things. And that is certainly huge as far as what takes up our envy time. But please, let's also realize often we are just envious of personality traits of others, right? Of abilities that people have, of attention that they get, of the relationships that they have. So let's make sure we are properly surveying the landscape of where we really do cling to the right to covet what other people have. And let's also be honest with ourselves that it's not just those who are closest to us, but often it is our brothers and sisters in Christ who we look at with very sinful and very destructive envy. And so we see though David is trying to deal with this by saying, okay, well, I'll have something good to feel about myself. I won't sin like these people over here. There we go. That's what I've got on them. I'm not going to open my mouth. But his heart is hot. And though you may not express often the envy you have for others, it eats away at you. You can't deny that and you can't avoid that. If you're going to indulge in coveting, it will eat away at you and your heart will be thick with discontent and heavy as a result and angry at God. And so David pinpoints the cause when he finally loses it, finally blurts out, okay, I hate this. His words are interesting. He says, the cause is that I do not recognize how fleeting I am. Really? The cause I don't realize that life is short? Not so much that. David is treating temporal things, the temporal wealth that these people are massing up in this situation, as though it's ultimate. And therefore saying, that is where true joy is found. This is what is most important. And then he's realizing, no, eternity is what is most important. And I have allowed these fleeting things to seem like they are ultimate. And I'm treating my earthly pleasures, my pursuit of them, as though these are ultimate and they must be satisfied. Lord, teach me how fleeting I am. That this life and its temporal things are a mere handbreadth. How often in verses 4, 5, and 6, he just says, they are just cast aside like nothing. A handbreadth is one of the smallest units of measure you'll find in that culture. So he's saying, this is really nothing. A mere shadow, he says. So why am I treating the pleasures of this life like they're ultimate? Lord, teach me what is most important. And so if that's the cause often of our envy, treating temporal things like they are ultimate, and then treating those desires, which might be good desires, as though they are demands we have a right to, then we turn on God and say, you've wronged me. And we act like we have a right to be angry, like our discontent is a legitimate thing. Please know, very often, what you will envy are very good things to have. It's good to want a healthy marriage. It's good to want a healthy body. Okay? Many of the things that you envy are good things. But the moment you turn them into a right that you are entitled to and act as though it's legitimate for you to be angry because your rights have been infringed on by God, now we are in a terrible place before him, very much like David, with a heart that is hot with anger at the Lord. So God responds as David asked him to. Okay? But he's been responding before David asks. And David finally can't take the discipline that God has given him. And so that's our second point here. If the cause is not realizing what is ultimate, that's why we become discontent with God, treating temporary things as though they are eternal. God responds to those situations with loving discipline. And we see in verse 11, what God has been doing to David. He says, "When you discipline a man with rebukes for sin, you consume like a moth what is dear to him. Surely all mankind is a mere breath." So we don't know exactly what form this discipline was taking on David. We don't know what God took from him. Could have just been his contentment, right? It could have just been his peace with being envious. God didn't let him progress down that road. He couldn't take it anymore. We don't know what God did. But we see that God lovingly gets in the way of our intent to sin. And so here he's saying, the things I'm idolizing, you're taking away. The things I've made ultimate, you're showing me are not. And why was God disciplining him here? To bring him to two realizations, okay? First realization is what he said in verse 4, his first outburst. "Teach me how fleeting I am." When we take things in this life and begin to worship them, I don't mean you actually bow down and pray to things this side of heaven, but when you make them so important that they are now things you're valuing more than what God has told you to value, God has to show you how inappropriate that is, how destructive that is, and so he will take steps to reduce the view you have, not reduce the view, reduce the size, I should say, or whatever this thing is in your life. It's become far too big, and God will lovingly reduce it so you can see what is truly ultimate. Now, that will often sometimes feel painful, right? Something we've gotten into a pattern of thinking about and obsessing over, and more that becomes familiar territory. When all of a sudden we are pulled off of that path, it can be very frightening. These things we have worshipped, the thought of losing them can sometimes think we can't go on without them. And often they're, again, very good things. And please don't hear me saying that I've got this down up here. Should God take away what is most dear to me, I don't know how I would respond. I don't like the thought of it at all. But all of us must come to the realization that we need to ask the Lord to help us see what is temporary and what is eternal, what deserves our worship, which is him and him alone, and what merely deserves good stewardship on our part, good treatment on our part, this side of heaven. And help us not make them into demands that we say we cannot live without. However, and I'm almost tempted to do an eyes thing, all right? Everyone, eyes, okay? Please, please, please do not twist this verse out of its context to turn it into a scare you straight kind of a sermon. When David says, "Lord, when you discipline someone, you take away these things," do not hear me saying, every one of you had better get your idolatry out of the way right now or God will take what's most precious to you. So fearfully, stop idolizing these things. Don't hear me saying that. Might God take away idols in your life? He most certainly may. But what David is trying to do in this psalm, what God is teaching us here, is not this big back end. I mean it. Stop worshiping those things or I'm taking them. What he's trying to do is show how much more sweet, how much more profound, how much more joy is found in God's promises that are eternal instead of chasing after what's fleeting. That's the point you got to walk away with from here. He doesn't just say, "Lord, take away these things from my life." He says, "Show me I'm fleeting. Give me a better perspective. Reorient me, because now this wealth that I'm envying over here has consumed me, and it shouldn't consume me. You should consume me. So, Lord, get my priorities straight again." And the way he got there was the Lord had been disciplining him lovingly. But what does the author of Hebrews say? No discipline is pleasant. It's always painful. But don't let the devil trick you into thinking that it's God's anger, that God has stopped loving you because of your idolatry. No, it's because he loves you that he's saying, "I'm not going to let you enjoy your idolatry. I'm not going to let you keep destroying yourself with coveting and envy. I'm going to lovingly take you off that path. But because we're clinging to things on that path that have become too precious, sometimes there is a painful extricating of these things out of our grasp. But it's God loving you when that happens. Don't listen to the devil's attacks that tell you it is his absence of love, that it is anger at you, because that can't be true for those that Christ has died for. The anger he has at sin, your sin, has been taken once and for all. So if David's first realization is that, okay, I am fleeting and these pleasures are fleeting and I've got to put them in the right category, that they are not what is ultimate, his second realization is in verse 7. And now, Lord, O Lord, for what do I wait? My hope is in you. This is a very important thing to see. David does not say, that's right, Lord, this life, this side of heaven is worthless. There's nothing worth doing here. There's nothing worth pursuing here. The only thing that's worthy is when I'm in heaven with you. Spiritual things are all that matters. David's not saying that. And too much of the church has said that over the years. What he's saying is, my hope is in you. And when my hope is in you, this world is put in perspective, and I see there's much good to do here. There's a lot of wonderful ways to glorify God with his incredible creation and the gifts he's given us this side of heaven. But only if we put them and keep them in proper perspective. Only when we do not make them what we worship, but worship God by treating these things he's given us well. Not idolizing our family, loving God by loving our family properly. Not idolizing my work, but loving God by being a good employee. And the list goes on and on. This creation is something that glorifies God. And every good thing he's given you should be cherished as a gift, not as a right, not as what is ultimate. David says, what is ultimate, you've now shown me, God, is you. That's where my hope is. So while he was raging in self-righteousness against the wicked who are heaping up wealth, and ultimately meaning raging against God, what does he say after verse 7 when he realizes, no, my hope is in you. Deliver me from my transgressions. The self-righteousness is gone once he realizes what he deserves from God. He deserves the punishment of the wicked. But he's realizing, I have an eternal hope in you, which I do not deserve to have. So instead of sitting here puffing myself up, licking my own wounds that I don't have what they have, but at least I'm better than they are, he says, forget them. Lord, forgive my sin. What a huge change in his attitude through that realization that his hope is in the eternal promises of God and not in what he can amass for himself here on earth, this side of heaven. So he is realizing, instead of being enraged at these other situations in God, I should be enraged at my own sin. Because if I can hope in his promises, which can't be broken, that I have an eternity that is guaranteed for me, then I have all I need for contentment this side of heaven. Now that line I just delivered to you, I admit, sounds too good to be true, coming out of my mouth. And I struggle to stand behind it, not because God is questionable, because I know my faith is weak. To think that I could say, if God took everything that is precious to me, this side of heaven, away, that I would still have everything I need for contentment, that's hard to believe. But the Bible promises it, and so it's true. It doesn't mean there wouldn't be tears. God doesn't promise us that we can be content and that therefore there's no tears. But it does mean that what we ultimately need to be able to stand before a holy God and a just God who must punish sinners, we have everything we need to stand before him and for him to look at you and say, well done, good and faithful servant. Come, enter my rest forever. That is guaranteed for you. And that can shine light into the darkest times when we are suffering this side of heaven, to know this will not last forever. This pain is not permanent. I have a hope that can't be taken away. And so David says something very interesting in verses 12 and 13. And here's our third point. God does not just discipline us. He also reminds us that we are sojourners here. This is not all there is, and we are going home. David says, "Hear my prayer, O Lord," in verse 12, "and give ear to my cry. Hold not your peace at my tears, for I am a sojourner with you, a guest like all my fathers." A better translation than guest there would be alien. He's giving you synonyms, a sojourner, an alien, like all my fathers. That's a very odd thing for especially someone of David's lineage to say about himself. I mean, the thing, the identity for the Israelites, I mean, it's still the identity today, the promised land, right? This is our land, promised to our forefather Abraham. And yet David says, "I'm just a sojourner like all my forefathers." What does he mean? He means, "Lord, I get it. I'm passing through. This is not my ultimate hope." That's hard for an Israelite to say. We finally got to the promised land. What does Hebrews say? If Joshua had given them rest, why was there still spoken of another day in the future where rest would finally come? The promising was just a picture, and David's getting that. Saying, "The best gifts you've given me this side of heaven, I'm passing through. It doesn't mean they're worthless. It just means as good as these gifts are, they cannot compare with what my eternity is going to be. So I've got to keep in mind, I'm a sojourner." But I'm not an aimless wanderer. We're sojourning with somebody. I'm a sojourner with you, oh God. And we are not just nomadic people. We're going somewhere. So this title of alien might seem often like, "Oh, you're displaced. You don't have a home." Well, we're not just aliens. We're sojourners. We're on a journey to our home, and that is guaranteed for us. So it's not just, "Hey, I'm just passing through because I'm going nowhere. I'm passing through because I'm going home." That means if you're not a citizen of this world, ultimately, you've got a better one you're waiting for. So this title, this description of alien, I want you all to cherish. The fact that you're a sojourner means this is not all there is. You're moving past what's here. Cherish that. It means you've got a seat on the ark. When the flood of judgment comes, you're one who did not remain. You're one who, thanks to the Lord, rose above the judgment water, ransomed by that covering God gave you of Christ. This is what Peter reminds us. Greg read this in Sunday school today. 1 Peter 2:9. "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul." If we're just passing through, we can't just get out of the caravan and say, "I'd rather not make it to the promised land. I'm going to stay right here in the desert." Or even worse, we saw in Numbers, "I want to go back to Egypt, to slavery." We have something so much better waiting for us. We can't let the passions of the flesh, Peter says, wage war against us. The passions of the flesh always want to make you think, no, immediate gratification right now is what will truly fulfill you. You have to take this opportunity. And Peter says, but if you remember you're a sojourner, you're saying, why would I go back to Egypt for a few onions? Why go to the promised land flowing with milk and honey? No, I'm not going to listen to you telling me to go back. I'm remembering where I'm going. I'm remembering that I don't deserve to be there, but it's guaranteed for me through Christ. So no, my hope is going to be there, not here. So in many ways, we are all like Abraham, right? God has called each of you through faith to follow him to a land you've never seen. You won't get to see it until you die, unless he comes. So we are saying, okay, I believe your promise that I'm going to get there. And I'm going to believe your promise that joy will be found there and not here. I'm not going to stay here. I'm going to go with you. The author of Hebrews explains this to us in chapter 11, verse 8. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. Jump to verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of the land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. Please remember that idea that you are an alien, but that is a blessed term because it means you've got a home better than what you're looking at around you. We have a better status as well in our covenant than even King David had. We have a better standing with God. God had put anger on David and let him feel that. So David begs him, look away from me that I may smile again. What that means is stop frowning at me. Remove your heavy hand from me for my sin so I can smile again, David says. We don't have to ask that. We have a better status than even David had. David was most assuredly saved by looking forward to what the Messiah would do someday, but we look back to work that is already accomplished for us. We possess the righteousness of Christ. We know God can never be angry at us again. We have the Holy Spirit who brings the power of the risen Christ in us, moving us to remember these promises so that we are not taken in by the devil's accusations. And so, remember that you are looking forward to a better country whose builder is God, and therefore, as he said, he's not ashamed to be called your God. Is that because you've performed so well? He's like, hey, check this guy out. I think I'll have him on my team. As his son Christ has performed in your place so much that he can look at you, no matter how badly you're struggling, and say, I delight in you as though you are as perfect as my son. I don't know if any of you have ever been displaced from your home by some kind of tragedy, whether it was a flood, burst pipes, a fire, who knows, maybe even just remodeling, and you're in a temporary situation, it is less than good. The in-laws' basement, or who knows what else, right? And what do you keep telling yourself the whole time as you're trying to keep the kids quiet with people who are not used to having the kids there or cleaning up this mess that the kids did or whatever else and living in this situation that is not a good one? What do you keep telling yourself? Just a few more weeks. Just a few more months. Kids, I know, but we'll be home. We'll be home soon. We need to have that mentality here. We don't know how long, and we know it's more than a few weeks or months most likely for all of us. But when the things are rough, you remind yourself, going home. This is not all there is. Whether it's your battle with sin that you're so tired of, wondering when are you going to make progress? Are God's promises really legit that I'm going to make progress over this? Remember, his promises are good. This is not the way you will always be. So take another step toward the promised land. Don't give up. You're going to get there. Whether it's just the brokenness of this world that weighs. Weighs on all of you so much. To make you doubt, is joy possible? And for some of you, I know you've thought it might not be. Please know, just a little longer. And joy you've never known will be yours forever. So you can keep taking another step toward the promised land because God has promised nothing will keep you out. Not your sin, not others' sin against you. It's guaranteed forever. And so, if our true hope gives us perspective on this life now, then let's live like it. Let's remember where our thoughts should be placed. On things above, Paul says. Not obsessing over earthly things. Again, not because we're going to be spiritual, mind over matter people, but putting things in perspective. What does Paul say to us in Colossians chapter 3? If you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you: sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. On account of these, the wrath of God is coming. In these you too once walked, when you were living in them, but now you must put them all away: anger, wrath, malice, slander, and obscene talk from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, seeing that you have put off the old self with its practices, and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator. Here there is not Greek, Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and in all. Put on then, as God's chosen ones, holy and dearly loved, put on compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another. And if one another has a complaint against another, forgiving each other, as the Lord has forgiven you. That's how we live when we are properly remembering what is ultimate and not making the things of this world as though they were where our hope lies. We desperately need God's help to do this because it is natural for us to cling to what is right in front of us. Instead of saying, no, I can let go of what is in front of me. I can give away to others what I'm clinging to because I have a hope that far outdistances anything this world could offer. So ask the Lord to help you remember the things of this world, as David said, are fleeting. Where is our hope? Our hope is in him.